So I think I wanted to start
Got
off
it, got the
by
approval, so we're
asking
good to
you
go.
just simply, how did you fall in love with baseball?
It's interesting. So when I was 6 years old, I had a bunch of friends that I would play with and just get out of the house and do different things with, and all of a sudden one day they weren't there. And on that particular day when they weren't there, I asked my parents, I said, "Hey, where are all my friends?" They said, "Oh, they went to go play baseball." I didn't want to be left out, so I said, "Well, I want to go there too." That's how I signed up to start playing T-ball. And that was kind of how I really got into it, because not only at that point was I able to watch it and play and be around it, I was also with my friends. So at the early age of six, it started quickly. And being in Chicago, I was very blessed where the Chicago White Sox were really community forward. They would always have Little League Day or School Day or Teacher Day. And that's how I went to my first major league game. So I was able to start connecting the dots, going, "Wow, I'm playing T-ball." And some of my idols and the heroes that I look up to and I think are really awesome are on the field and I can watch them. Maybe one day that could be me. That's how it kind of all unfolded and started.
So, that's really interesting. Let me ask you, was your dad a big baseball person, or was anybody in your house a big baseball person?
It was a combination of both. My dad was a big baseball person, and his mother, my grandma, was also a big baseball person. So when my grandma would come visit, she would come anywhere from once to twice a year. She lived in Mississippi, and she would always bring some sort of gift. And I remember she brought me a Minnesota Twins, one of those plastic helmets where you can adjust it on the inside with the little strap. And that was like my first ever pro baseball helmet. It came from my grandma. And my dad played 16-inch softball, which is a really big thing in the Chicagoland area. So he would always bring me to the ballpark with him, and I would watch and play with him. And I think one thing that a lot of people forget, I'm going to be 42 years old here soon. So if you think back to when I was 6 years old, when times were just slightly different, having one television in the house was something big. You didn't have multiple televisions. And if you did have a television, the people in control of the television were probably the adults and the parents. So if my dad was watching baseball, there was no, "Hey, dad, can you change the channel and put something else on?" It was, "We're watching baseball." So if he was watching it or if he was taking me with him, I was surrounded by baseball a lot. So it was combination dad, combination grandma, and then a lot of my friends as well.
So you mentioned how you fell in love with baseball. So now that leads me to wonder, growing up playing T-ball and then playing for Lansing Little League, what positions did you play in your youth, and what was your favorite to play and why?
One of the coolest things looking back when I was in the T-ball, you played every position. And I remember it starting to warm up and get hot. And I started in Linwood Little League before transferring over to Lansing Little League at the age of 13. I used to always remember it would be hot in the summertime. And when you would come off the field between innings, the catchers got so much love. They would get the wet towel to put over their shoulder. They would get the orange slices. They would get the extra water. And I go, "I'm hot too. I'm out here hot." And so when I got a chance to catch and put on all the catcher's equipment and do that, even for just a brief moment in T-ball, it was fun. As I started to move up into Little League, I started out as a shortstop. And as I got into high school, at a freshman in high school, when our center fielder would pitch, that's how I ended up in the outfield, and I would go to center field and play. And that was the rest of it.
Interesting. I'm now wondering who were some of those people early on in your life? Who were those baseball mentors of yours? Those people who really took you under their wing and taught you the fundamentals of how to play the game, and that helped ended up molding you into the player that you became.
It's interesting. I never had instruction or training camp. I played multiple sports, and whenever one sport would finish, I would roll into the next sport. So basketball was the winter sport, and once that would finish, I would get ready to go straight into baseball. So in the off season or in the winter or whenever I wasn't playing baseball, I wasn't getting lessons. I wasn't going to camps, but I was always doing some sort of game type initiative that would kind of bring me around it, whether that was, "Hey, let's throw the ball off the wall and practice fielding ground balls," or something like that. Or, "Hey, let's see if we can hit it with our hand, this piece of paper, in a swinging motion." So without realizing, I was getting repetition over and over again without having to actually take lessons. So then once I would start to join the teams and do different things like that, it was my coaches primarily And I give a lot of credit to my first ever coach, which was a female. Her name was Miss Lass, L-A-S. So at the age of 6 years old, my first ever coach was a female. And as I retire at the age of 38 years old, I never had another female coach ever since. And the reason I mentioned that being such a big thing is if that female coach of mine that I had, whose son was also on the team with me, treated me differently than she did, I may not have wanted to come back to the game, but she was so respectful and so helpful and just loving and treating us all like her son. I was excited to get back out there and continue to keep playing again. And that's how it kind of started. And then once we fast forward and I get into Little League, Tony Wasnonis, who was the son, his dad, Tony Wasnonis Sr., was the coach of the team and was really big into the game about, you know, the stats and trying to keep us going. And he would always give us the baseball at the end of the year that would have our year-end accomplishment, how many home runs, how many hits, what our average was. So that's how I started learning about the stats and the numbers of the game. At the age of 8 years old, I still had those baseballs at home. My parents had those. And then, you know, fast forward, it was my high school coaches at TF South, Coach Reynolds and Coach Anderson. And then my head coach in college, Coach Mike D. So I've had different mentors along the way that all brought different things to the table that were very helpful throughout the course of my career.
Growing up as an adolescent watching the game on TV, who were some of your favorite players to watch on TV? And could you maybe tell me what was it about that guy that you liked so much?
There were a couple of them. King Griffey Jr. is my all-time favorite. And part of the reason why I really loved him and thought he was just the coolest is, one, he had his own video game. I mean, at that time, Nintendo was taken over by storm, and the fact that he had his own video game and looked really cool on the game, batted left-handed like I did. He's the reason why I swing a black baseball bat, because he did it. So there was a lot of things in it that you saw him. He wore his hat backwards, which was actually by accident. I'm not sure if you ever heard the story about that. He wore his hat backwards because of his dad gave him a hat when he brought him to the field, and it was too big. So instead of having it on his head forward and it keep falling over his eyes, he turned it backwards because he wanted to keep it on. People took pictures of it, and then everyone thought, you know, he was trying to be cool and do it that way. But that's all it was. The hat was just too big. He turned it backward, and he just happened to look cool while doing it. That tends to be how a lot of the fashion and style happens, not when you're trying to.
So I wanted to, for a minute, I wanted to fast forward your high school career at TF South. Could you recall for me what, in your mind, what is the most memorable game that you were involved in while at TF South?
The most memorable game that I ever played in was my last ever game at TF South as a senior. The game we actually lost. It was in the regional championships. We're in the playing against Homewood Flossmoor. We're two of the best teams in the area. And we get out to a big lead. I think it was 10-5. And then all of a sudden it started raining. So there was a little bit of a rain delay. Well, after that rain delay, Homewood Flossmoor comes back and ends up beating us like 15-10 or something crazy. It just ended up being this crazy game that ended up going back and forth. There were home runs hit. There were grand slams hit. There were runs scored. There were a number of pitching changes. And this would have been the first time in my high school career that we would have advanced from the regional championship to the sectional championship with an opportunity to play in the state tournament. And if it wasn't for that rain, it slowed us down, and that was it. And it's one of the games that a lot of my teammates that I grew up playing with on that team, we still talk about to this day.
Where would that game play at? Would that game at HF?
That game was played at Homewood Flossmoor, at HF, yep.
Okay. Wow. So, you know, you go through your time at TF South, and obviously you were a very accomplished player at TF South at during your high school career. But I'm wondering now, because as you alluded to earlier, you were also a multi-sport person, whether that be cross country or basketball. So I guess I'm wondering now, well, at TF South, were your eyes set on making the majors or not at that point?
No, not even close. I mean, the majors was always cool, and anytime you got a chance to go to a game and you would see those players and you would practice and emulate them. Oh, I'm Ken Griffey Jr. in this pretend at bat in the practice field. That was as far as I ever took it. My goal and dream at that time was to take Division I college basketball, not even the NBA. And it's funny to think about being in Chicago, you know, where Michael Jordan had 6 championships growing up in the 90s. Who didn't want to be like Mike? But I just love college basketball. I'm a huge Kansas Jayhawk fan. And anytime I got a chance to watch them and cheer for them, that's what I would do. I'd buy Kansas jerseys. That's where my goal and dream was. There wasn't really much about the baseball side of it. And then my senior year in high school, I don't get any recruitment letters in basketball. All the recruitment letters I get are for baseball. So I started realizing, okay, well, maybe this might be the opportunity for me. But even with that being said, I was still hopeful that I would get a chance to play college basketball. So I signed in college to play baseball with a scholarship with the opportunity to also play basketball. So my freshman year of college, I do my first basketball workout followed by a baseball practice. And then I'm going to have my first official basketball practice the next day. Well, at baseball practice that day, I end up sliding into second base and breaking my thumb. And I said, ah, man, there goes my basketball dream. Well, let's see what ends up happening with the baseball stuff. And the rest was history.
What position were you in basketball at that time?
I was a point guard. I was very facilitative. I loved helping, setting picks, passing, getting assists. But I could also shoot. I made it to the state tournament in a three-point contest my senior year as well. I just didn't shoot a lot when I played, but I could shoot. So I just loved the game. It could have been that Chicago in me that was always around. So that's why I was always around it that way. But I was a point guard, though.
Were you, real quick, were you on the basketball team at South as well?
Yeah, so I made the varsity team my sophomore year in basketball and also baseball. So when we start looking at my career and you go, okay, which one's better? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm starting to bump up. I'm starting to move the ranks in both sports. So I'm thinking, hey, I'm doing good at both of these. And I think what the reason why baseball kind of took off for me is baseball is so individual, even though it's a team sport. You have to hit. Once the ball comes to you, you have to catch it. You have to steal the base. In basketball, I can do a lot of things without the ball in my hand and still have success, but not necessarily bring a lot of attention to myself. So whereas I'm very unselfish in baseball, when it's your time to hit, you got to hit. You can't really be unselfish. And I think that's what kind of started to step my baseball side up, because I wanted to help the team. So therefore, I had to improve my hitting. I wanted to make a great play. So therefore, I had to improve my defense. I had to steal a base. So therefore, I had to improve my running skills. Or in the basketball side, I can get you open. I would find you cutting to the lane and you'd get an easy 2 points or be wide open for a three. And I was just always good at that. I didn't have to work on that too much more. And that's why the baseball side of it just continued to excel.
So you mentioned, you got letters and scholarships to play baseball in college. You ended up going to UIC, University of Illinois at Chicago. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you were drafted by Detroit early. Is that correct?
Yes, third round.
Okay. You were, in terms of early, I mean, you were a junior, correct?
Yep, yeah, for my third year at UIC, a junior year.
Yes. So was it ever a question in your mind that you were not going to go back and finish up your degree, or did you know at that point, okay, education is something that I value, I'm going to go back and finish out my degree?
Education has always been at the forefront. Both my parents taught in the Chicago public school system. My sister currently teaches at the college level, and college was just something that I knew I was going to do. I went to college because I had an opportunity to play baseball, but I was going to graduate college because that was the thing that I was going to do regardless. So when the opportunity presented itself for me to get drafted and move ahead, that didn't throw a monkey in the wrench. I was really set to go back for my senior year, but my college coach, Coach Mike D, who I alluded to, was such a mentor. He said, you've done everything you can do at this level. You got to go on to the next level. And he's the big reason why I signed. I was ready to go back to college. I had all my classes registered. I had my dorm picked out. I had all that stuff. And because I was ready to go back to school, I was able to continue with school, even though I signed my professional contract. So my first year in pro ball, I play that fall. I come back and I'm registered for all my classes. So I just roll into my senior fall. That senior spring was the first time I had seen an online class offered at UIC. And again, this is dating me. This is 2003. So the only way I was able to access this class, I had to go to the public library in Lakeland, Florida, get on their internet to be able to submit my homework when need be. And my finals for my class, I had to take in front of my manager in his locker room. He had to sign off to say I didn't cheat. And then I would FedEx my final paper and final exam to my teachers. They would email it to me to let me know my grade. I passed my classes. And I had one more class left, which would have been after my senior summer. That was a class I had to take in person. That was my heavy presentation class. And Dave Kohler, who I really credited for being able to get my degree, because that's the one class you can't miss. And I was like, okay, that's going to be the curveball here. He said, take the class with me in the summertime. I know you're not going to be here. I'll give you an incomplete and we'll finish it in the fall when you come back. So I came back, I finished it in the fall with him. I passed, so I was able to graduate. And I remember telling the Detroit Tigers when I signed my contract, one of the big things that they send a lot of players to is called instructional league. I said, look, I know you want me to go to instructional league. I'll do that, but I'm not going my first year. I got to go back to school. And I said, okay, we'll let you do that as long as you go your second year. So communication was key. Everybody was on board, and I was able to graduate on time with my class.
That is wild. Can you, sticking with your time at UIC, can you recall for me, what would you say is your most memorable game that you played in while at UIC?
At UIC, I would say most memorable game, and I think this is what kind of started us going. We're in Homestead, Florida, my junior spring, and we're off to a really good start. I think we're playing like 6-1 or something like that. And now we're getting ready to play the Ohio State University down in Florida. Nick Swisher was on that team, and that team was ranked number 23 or 24 in the country. Now, coming from UIC, we were a mid-major school. We thought we were good, but we obviously had to beat good teams in order to prove we were good. Here's our chance to play one of the top-ranked teams in the country. We go out there, and we beat them. I have no idea what I did statistically in that game, but I remember that game standing out. And from that point, that Homestead tournament, we'd also played Ball State, who had the number one pitcher in the country. Last name was Bullinger. Forgot his name, first name, but he was the number one draft pick in 2002. And they had just beat number one Miami the day before. We beat them. So all of a sudden, we're just beating these teams. And then more and more scouts, more and more eyeballs are starting to come onto it. And we're playing well. I'm playing well. It's a combination of so many different things. But I remember it all starting when we got a chance to beat Ohio State down there in Homestead.
You go through your time at UIC. You get drafted by the Tigers. You finish out your degree. And then you end up going to instructional league, as you alluded to. How would you describe your path to the majors? Was it easy? Was it difficult? How would you describe that journey to making it to the major league roster?
It was almost non-existent because I get drafted my junior year and everyone's talking about, oh, you know, what do you think? How do you think it's going to go? Do you think you're going to make it? All this, that, and the other. And I told a lot of people, I said, you know what? I'm probably going to play for 2 to 3 years in the minor leagues. I'll get released and then I'll put my degree to work. And that was where my mindset was. There was no thinking I'm going to make it to the major leagues. And my first year in short season, I played really well. I was second in the league in batting average. My third year, I make the All-Star team. And at this point, I'm just hating baseball at this point. I'm playing well, but I'm just not liking where I'm at. I'm in Lakeland, Florida. It's hot. It's Florida in the summertime in the Florida State League. And I always tell everybody the toughest leagues in baseball are the major leagues, followed by high A ball in the Florida State League, and then it goes AAA, AA on the way down. And for anyone that's listening or going to read this, the reason why the Florida State League is such a challenging league, if you've ever been in Florida in the middle of summer, it's hot, it's humid. We play at really nice stadiums because we play at the spring training facilities, but there's no fans that are coming to sit outside at a minor league baseball game in July when it's 95 degrees plus 100% humidity. So I'm best, we're averaging in our home ballpark in Lakeland about 300 fans in a stadium that can hold almost 8,000 or 9,000 fans. So it was just frustrating. I had some personal things going on and I was really about to quit. I was like, you know what? I don't need all this. Let me go ahead and quit. I'm about to get my degree soon. I can go back to Chicago. They had just opened up a Nike Town. I thought that I might work for Nike Town at that time. I was a marketing and business management major, and I would be bringing out the next newest, coolest baseball shoes to the next level of kids. That's where my mindset was. And what's most funny and interesting about it is that's 2003. I'm this close to quitting. In 2004, after talking to a bunch of friends, talking to our team psychologist and mental skills coach to just kind of maintain and stay through it, I end up getting called up to the big leagues the next year. So as close as I was to quitting, I was that close to making it to the major leagues. And 2.5 years after getting drafted, I finally get my major league debut.
Well, I'm certainly glad, you know, that you stuck with it. As I'm sure are a lot of fans.
Thank you. Yeah, it's crazy to think about. I mean, I was about to be done with it, and it wasn't the baseball itself. It was all the other things. So like I said, I was playing well, but it was all the other stuff that I was like, you know what? I don't need this. I can go and do a bunch of other different things. And outside of Nike Town, I don't know what else I was thinking about doing.
So you finally make it to the majors. And I guess I wanted to fast forward here to a little bit to 2012. So in my researching for this interview, I was doing some light digging on your stats. And I noticed that in 2012, you had a 28-game on-base streak, which got me thinking. So that was the longest such streak of your career. I'm not sure if you were aware of that. But as a player, were you generally aware of stuff like that, like of streaks that you're in the middle of? Say, I'm in the middle of a 40-game hit streak or 28-game on-base streak. Would that generally be something that you thought about, or did you just go out there and play every day?
I didn't know exactly what type of streak I might have been on, but I would know, hey, I've done well the last couple games, or I have been on base, it seems like, the last week. Now, that could be 7 days worth of games. That could be 5 days worth of games. That I may lose track of. But the way you would always know is somebody in the media would always ask you, hey, you got a 10-game streak. You got a 15-game streak. So that's how you found out. Even if you didn't want to know about it, you would find out that way. So I didn't really know it as much just because there was so much happening. As you start to move up the ranks and get to the major league, it's game after game. It's series after series. It's pitcher after pitcher. So you start losing a little bit, but you know when you're going good, and you also know when you're going bad. And when you're going good, there's a chance that you might be in the middle of some sort of streak. So it's not foreign. So if someone were to say, hey, you've been on base 20 days in a row, I may not know the exact number of days, but I'm like, okay, yeah, I have been on base a lot. I didn't know it was 20 days.
I wanted to switch gears for a minute because you mentioned the media. I think it's fair to say that throughout your career, you earned a reputation as one of the most easygoing, just all around nice guys. So I wanted to ask you about your relationship with the media. Was it always easy, or were there times where you just woke up and you said, I can't face the media today for whatever reason? Or were you one of those guys that was just happy to get in front of a camera and talk to a reporter?
Well, there are definitely times where you didn't feel like doing it, but I knew that came with the territory, you know, getting a chance to be blessed to be one of the best baseball players in the entire world playing on that level. You're going to have to ask her questions about what went well, what went wrong, and why. And I remember Gary Sheffield mentioning something to me. He said when he played with the Yankees, one of the things he always made sure he did is if he had a bad game, he was the first one at his locker to do an interview. That way, when he had a good game, or if there was any game in the middle, the media would never look at him and say, oh, he only talks when he plays good. Now, I never had a schedule like that, but it was something that stuck with me and said, regardless, I got to be accountable. I got to talk about it. I remember moments where I slipped in the World Series in 2006, and they came straight to me and asked me about it. This was early in my career. I could have ran away and blamed the field or blamed something else, but I said, I slipped. I should have been in a different position to make a play on the ball. And I think a lot of that went a long way to be able to allow the respect. So I didn't duck and dodge those questions. Now, there are some times where I was frustrated to talk to the media, and I did call them out on it. Towards the end of my career, there was a situation. I'm playing with the New York Mets, and we are in Atlanta. On this particular day, we're playing the Braves, and Adam Jones, the outfielder for the Baltimore Orioles, has a scenario where he's playing in Boston, and a fan throws a banana at him, and it becomes this whole media spectacle. Luckily for me, I happened to be watching some sort of baseball news outlet before leaving the hotel, whether it was SportsCenter, MLB Network, or whatever it happened to be. So I knew the story had just happened. And as I'm taking the bus to the stadium, I'm telling myself, as soon as I walk in this clubhouse, the media is going to come up to me and ask me about the scenario that was affected Adam Jones. And I'm thinking to myself, why are they only going to talk to me? So sure enough, as soon as I walk in the clubhouse, I get situated and the media gets access. Here they come to my locker and start talking to me. Before I started answering a question, I said, hey, I'm going to answer any question you have for me. But I understand that this did happen to an African-American player. I am an African-American player, and I'll give you my thoughts and feedback on it. But it also happened to a baseball player. There's 24 other baseball players in this locker room. So definitely make sure you go talk to those other baseball players and not just the black player on this team. And they all were like, oh, yeah, well you know why we got to talk to them. I understand, but also know that you should also talk to them. And I don't know who all they ended up speaking to afterwards. I'm not sure if it got press or attention. But there are times where, you know, hey, I understand they have a job to do, but they also have to be respectful, too, of the scenarios and situation. And the ones that were at least as researched and educated going into the questioning, we always respected. I always loved someone that would actually ask a question. There were some reporters that would not ask a question. They would say, it's hot out. Okay, what's the question? What? You know, and then now I'm in a position where I can dig myself a hole. Or you have somebody that didn't necessarily know the sport or what had happened. And that's not always their fault. I learned that a lot of media members that end up in, whether it's reporting or highlights of the games, don't necessarily get to pick the sport that they want. So you may have somebody that has no clue about baseball, but they ended up working in baseball. So that I'm not too disappointed in, because a lot of them would acknowledge that, hey, baseball is not my top sport. I'm here working for this network or this media, so bear with me. Great. Now you've laid the groundwork. I'll try to break it down as best I can and help, you know, so we can keep the conversation moving. So, and I think, in a nutshell, you know, having these business marketing and management classes and having to do presentations in front of the class made it easier for me to be able to handle the media. But, you know, it just took time and repetition to me to be able to do so.
So I think it's fair to say that baseball is very much of a team game, just as much as it is an individual game, which got me thinking, who were some of your favorite teammates that you played with in the majors? And in asking this question, I'm wondering, who were those guys, especially early on in your major league career, that took you under their wing and showed you the ropes of how to be a major league baseball player and thrive at the major league level?
So Demetri Young was the first player with the Detroit Tigers. He took me underneath his wing as soon as I made that team. You know, from, hey, this is what time you show up to the ballpark. So these are the suits you wear. This is where you go eat. This is how we get to the road ball for all those different things. And it's somebody that I still communicate with to this day. Very thankful that I had an individual like that who was established, who had had some success, and who saw the importance of, hey, let me go ahead and try to steer you in a direction to avoid some of the challenges and hurdles that I had early on in my career. So he was definitely the first one that jumped out at me. From there, Marcus Thames is my all-time favorite teammate. Him and I are buddies, real close. We play with the Tigers, we play with the Yankees, and we just talked throughout the course of, you know, life, even till now. We've stayed in touch in so many different ways. So those two definitely stand out the most. And I think partly because I was in such an impactful position with the Detroit Tigers. Marcus and I had both made the team at that time in 2006, so that was a bonding moment. And we've gone to the World Series in 06 and all these different connection points. But I've been blessed to think about the number of teammates that I've had along the way, from Andrew Jones, who I was a huge fan of. I got to play with him, Ichiro, Derek Jeter, A-Rod, Cano, Speaky, David Wright, Jose Reyes, just to name a few. Lucas Duda was another fun one that I loved playing with the Mets. Yoenis Cespedes, Bartolo Colon, I played with twice. Loved facing him, loved playing against him, loved playing with him. So, I mean, looking back at my career, like, I was truly blessed. I had some great teammates across the board.
So, I want to get to your postseasons in a minute. But first, could you tell me, of all of the managers and coaches that you played for and under in the majors, who was the one that you enjoyed the most? That really taught you the most?
Jim Leland, hands down. And I, again, being in such an impactful point of my career, making a team. He had just taken a job in 2006. And outside of him wearing full baseball uniform, including metal baseball cleats at practice and during the game, in the dugout, which is not normal. Most managers do not do that. But he said, hey, if you're going to play, I'm going to dress like a player. We're going to be the same. And that set the tone right away. I'm no different than you. You're no different than me. I don't care if you're making the league minimum or if you have the biggest salary in all of baseball. I'm the manager. I'm in control. You're the players. I'm going to respect you. You respect me. And we go from there. And from day one, he laid the groundwork. And if you remember, in 2006, the Detroit Tigers make the World Series. But in 2003, just a short while prior, we were one loss away from setting the all-time record for most losses in a major league season. So a quick turnaround had happened, thanks in part to Jim Leland and the Detroit Tigers organization. But he definitely let everyone know, you know, respect, do not believe the hype, come ready to play, play every day, get the most out of you. He'd call you out on it. And the way I love that he called people out on it, if I struggled or had a mistake, he'd obviously call me out on it. But it was also an opportunity and time for him to yell at the entire team. So I was never singled out. And when you get singled out, that's when players start to shut down. And I remember him having a couple of great rants where we may have, you know, made a couple of errors or missed a couple of signs. So he'll come and start talking about that. And then he'll start talking about somebody not picking up the baseballs in the cage or someone who was late for the bus or somebody. And he wouldn't name them. He would just mention a scenario. So you knew it was you. And you were included in getting yelled at by everyone else. And if he forgot, once he would walk out of the meeting and you thought the meeting was over, he would come back in and continue his rant at everybody. But he always finished it on a high note and everybody laughed at the end of it. But he got his point across. And Jim Leland, hands down, was the one I learned the most from and was just so happy that I had him at that point in time in my career.
Who were some of those? Who was your favorite as well as your least favorite pitcher to face in the majors? And in asking this question, I'm curious to know what it was about that dude who made him say your favorite or your least favorite. Was it something in his delivery that just made it easier for you to pick up the spin of a baseball? Or what was it about that guy who made you feel that way?
For me, my favorite was Bartolo, because Bartolo threw 98% fastball, and I love hitting fastball, and he would just throw fastball after fastball, and it didn't matter what game it was, what situation it was, he knew he had a great fastball, and he was going to throw it and get it by most players. And case in point, in 2005, he's coming off of winning Cy Young either that year, the 2004, 2003, right before that, he had just won a Cy Young, so he's one of the best pitchers in the game. He's throwing 98 before a lot of pitchers were throwing 98. And he's the player that I ended up getting my first inside the park home run off of, because he just kept throwing me fastballs. And I like hitting fastballs. So I love facing him. And then all of a sudden, towards the end of our careers, he's with the Atlanta Braves. And I'm facing him. And he throws me a changeup for the first time ever. And I pop it up. And I'm running around the base. And I said, hey, you don't ever throw a changeup. He goes, I know. You like fastballs, my friend. So just in the middle of the game, we're laughing at each other. But that was the relationship the two of us had. Now, in terms of the pitcher I hated the most was Scott Downs. Did not like facing Scott Downs, the lefty. I just couldn't pick him up very well. And he did an interview recently where he said, I remember an interview or him and I talked. I don't remember how it came about. But he said, I remember facing you in spring training. And you hit a home run off me in spring training. And I learned from that moment, don't throw that again. And I was like, oh, man, you know, I hurt myself by having success off him early. And I think from that point on, I was 0 for 10 in my career against Scott Down.
That is hilarious. I wanted to, for a moment, before I get to your postseasons, I wanted to turn your attention to umpires. And I want to ask this question in two ways. And if you don't want to answer this first part, I understand. But as a fan, I've always been curious about this. It seems to me that if you're a major league player, and please tell me if I'm wrong here, it seems like you wake up and you see, oh my, Jerry Mills is doing the plate today. I'm going to have a great day at the plate. Or Jerry Mills is doing the plate. I'm not going to have a good day at the plate. A, is that true generally for major league players? And B, can you tell me what it is about the ump that about the plate umpire that would make you feel that way going into a game?
For me personally, I never thought of it that way. I never knew who the umpires were for a given day until we actually walked out and I saw them. It was just not part of my routine. I know some players did buy more catchers, more pitchers, and some hitters. And I knew a lot of the umpires by face and body. Unfortunately, I actually didn't know a lot of their names, but I was always talking to them, whether they were at home plate or, you know, I made it to first, second, or third or something like that. Hey, what's going on? How you doing? All these different things. Ted Barrett, I knew, was a big boxer, so him and I connected over that. And there was a few other ones that we would just talk about different things. But again, I didn't know all of their names off the top. But you say their name, like, oh, yeah, I know who that is. So that's how it was for me. In terms of, like, the ones that weren't so good or weren't so bad, same thing. I never felt like there was much going on. But I did have a recent moment that happened last year. And it happened in Birmingham, Alabama, of all places. I'm in a hotel, I'm in the lobby, and there are all these college football teams there. I think it's the SEC, the Sun Belt, and a few other conferences there. So they all have on their college uniform shirts, and they see each other. I get in the elevator, and one of the guys goes, hey, are you a football coach? I said, no, I just retired from baseball. And the first thing he says after that is, I'm like, oh, that's great. He said, hey, do you know which pitch umpires miss the most? And I was like, wow. You know, that's the first question I get. I said, no, I don't. But I said, for me, I always felt it was the pitch down and away. And he said, do you bat left-handed or right-handed? And I said, I bat left-handed. He said, you're correct. It's not necessarily that it's that pitch. But he said, and I don't know where he got this stat from. So, you know, if you can find a way to confirm this, this would be great. He said that most umpires are right-eye dominant. And the pitch down and away to them from a lefty is the furthest away from them. So it's hard to gauge the bottom of the zone and the outside part of the zone. And I said, that's the pitch I always knew balls were not on the plate and they would get called strikes a lot. Not because they were down, more so because they were off. And I said, you're my best friend. I always would say that. I don't know who this individual was, but I've never been able to fact check that. But obviously umpires are left or right eye dominant. Are they more right eye dominant? That I don't know. But there are some things in play. When that catcher is standing there, and the umpire is in the safest spot he can be, which is in between the catcher and the batter, then the outside pitch is the furthest thing that he'll see. So you should say, well, that should be the same thing for right-handed hitters too, for the other way. But for some reason, being in center field, I feel like I never saw that pitch get called nearly as much as I saw it against left-handed hitters. So, and it had nothing to do with who the umpire was. I just felt like a lot of umpires didn't necessarily get that pitch correct all the time.
So I wanted to stay with the plate here for a minute. And as a fan, I've always loved baseball, I think more than other sports, because of the human error of the game. Now, you never like to see an umpire get a play wrong, but I've loved that human error, that human aspect of the game. So I wanted to ask you, as a former player, I wanted to get your thoughts on the quote unquote robo ump on an automated zone. I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
They have different ways where they're evaluating the umpires already. So an umpire knows at the end of the game or the next day how many strikes they got called correct, that they called strikes, how many strikes did they miss, that they called balls, et cetera, et cetera. So they're already getting evaluated on it. The thing is, we as the players don't necessarily know that information. But trying to merge the two is a very interesting thing. I'm all for the idea of, I understand mistakes happen, but if we're going to go ahead and have some sort of robo-ump, it has to be in real time. The game already has a slow element to it. I don't want to have to wait. I don't want to have to challenge all the time. It's got to be quick. If you can do it quick and still have the human element to call it or signal it, I think it could be a good thing, because you want to get it right as many times as you can. But at the same time, I don't want to have to pause, look back, wait for them to get a signal to go ahead and make a determination if it's a ball or a strike. A lot of stuff can happen in that time while we're waiting. Mm-hmm. So definitely don't want to see that. And I think one thing a lot of people forget, players make a lot of errors, we strike out, we miss, we lose a lot of games. And when the crowd is cheering and booing and going on stuff, you get amped up, you get nervous, you get excited. The same holds true for the umpires. You notice how in a big situation, when it's a call third strike, it tends to be louder than it was in the second inning when there was no one on base. You know, it's more dramatic. It's more impactful. If they're doing a safe and out call, you know, they do all those great things bigger in the bigger moments. They're feeling that energy too. They're human. That's just part of it. So I do like that side of it, and I like that excitement, especially when someone gets called out or called safe in a big moment. It helps with the fans as well. Yes. So you take a robo side of it, and there's just a, you know, a game-winning play, and all of a sudden they go safe. Oh, man. Uh-huh. You know, I didn't get that excitement of that.
Yes. So I wanted to turn your attention now. You've been alluding to that 2006 postseason run that you were involved in with the Tigers. Looking back on your career, which postseason run stands out to you?
Two of them for me. It's a mix. That one and the 15, just because we both made it to the World Series in them. Mm-hmm. And in each scenario, I felt like we had a really good chance to win the World Series. In 06, all of a sudden, we as an entire team couldn't hit, we couldn't field, we couldn't do anything right. Everything we had done prior to in the previous rounds of the playoffs, we just couldn't do. And we were playing a team we had swept during the regular season in the St. Louis Cardinals. And then we went out there and ended up losing five games, and it was not pretty. And on the flip side, in the 2015 one, I thought we were really matched well against Kansas City. I thought we had opportunities. And I think a couple things did go right, but they just ended up being just one step ahead of us. Game one, I thought, was a crucial turning point. If we win that game, then that puts us in at least being 1-1 coming back home to New York versus being down 0-2 coming back to New York. We win game three, which may or may not have happened, but that's a whole big turning point instead of trying to win a game to get to 2-1 versus winning a game, or to be 1-2 in a series versus winning a game, and now you're 2-1 in a series with a chance to possibly win at home. So those are the two biggest ones that stand out to me. Nothing I would really replay, because that's just part of it. You get hot and you get cold throughout the course of the season. Like, even looking at that 2006 run, we played a New York Yankees lineup that was monstrous. We had Giambi and Sheffield and A-Rod and Jeter and all these players. I think Pettit and Mussina and Mariano and Posada. I mean, this is a great team. And we have to open up there. And we end up losing our American League Central Championship on the last weekend of the season, which made us the wild card team. So instead of hosting at home, we're now on the road playing against the Yankees. So all that is going into it. I mean, nobody is picking us to win, but then we had two young pitchers that the world didn't really know about, and Justin Verlander and Joel Zumaya. And they were throwing 100 miles an hour, and it were shadows in Yankee Stadium, and those hitters could not see. And we were able to win those games, come back to Detroit, and that place was rocking, and we ended up beating them to advance. But same thing, you can argue and say, well, hey, if there were no shadows in that game and the Yankees hit the way that they were capable of, they should have handled us pretty nicely. But that's just part of baseball. Sometimes you're on the winning side of it, sometimes you're not.
So looking back on your major league career, what aspect of your game are you the most proud of?
I'm most proud that I was able to play center field in the major league. When I got drafted and I signed, I remember going to Comerica. And that was at the time before they had moved the fences in. And now they're about to move them in again for, I think, a third time. And it was a big ballpark. There was a flagpole that was in play in center field that was 428 feet away. And the biggest field I had ever played on was 400 feet to center. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, there's no way I'm going to be able to play center field out here. And I played the corner and I played center field in college, but this is in college. And even a lot of the write-ups, Baseball America you know, it was a big publication at that time about prospects, the pros and the cons, and they were honest and detailed. And when that was one of the biggest things, that I'm a good outfielder, but I'm too slow to play center, and I don't have enough power to play on the corner. And that became motivation for me. How do I play center field, and how do I play center field at the big league? And Andy Van Slyke, our outfield coach we had with the Detroit Tigers, was big into pushing me. He pushed and pushed and challenged me, play shallower, go after this ball, go after that ball, catch everything you can. And that turned me into a solid center fielder to be able to stay out there for a very long time.
So I think it's fair to say, and you were a very accomplished baseball player in your major league career, but I think it's fair to say, and I think you would agree with me, that when it comes to the hardware, you know, gold gloves, silver sluggers, rings, you don't have the resume that some guys have. But one thing that you do have that a lot of guys don't have is you were the winner of the Roberto Clemente Man of the Year Award in 2016. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious because, and I asked this question because Clemente is my favorite player, because his story has really, it really resonated with me as a young kid, in that I loved giving back just like him. And I saw that there was this baseball player who did that. So I'm wondering, what does having a Clemente Award mean to you?
Looking at the two sides, you talked about all the other hardware, and I think for gold gloves and silver sluggers and even MVPs to some extent, those were never on my list of things to get. I would have loved to have gotten them. I felt like there were times I was qualified for some of those awards. But the way the structuring of the awards are and who's voting for them or how you can win them can kind of let people forget about teams and players that are doing a great job. For example, in 2007, I wasn't even on the All-Star roster for the potential voting ballot, because at that time, the All-Star game was going to be played in a National League ballpark. I'm not sure which ballpark it was, but it was going to be in a National League ballpark. And each team had to submit their players. So you put your three outfielders, and if you had somebody else, they put them down as a DH. Well, on our team, we had Gary Sheffield. I think we had Craig Monroe, who was established. We might have had Dimitri Young. And it was one of the outfielders. I can't remember who it was at that time. Well, all of them got put on there, and I was left off. And the reason I referenced 2007, this is the year that Jimmy Rollins and myself did the 2020-2020. And I was well on my way at the All-Star break, but I wasn't on the ballot in front of people, so you couldn't vote for me. So I think at that time, I ended up having the most write-in votes all time in MLB history, because I was putting up good numbers, but I wasn't on the main thing. So, of course, I wasn't elected to an All-Star. So just different things like that, that kind of go into the mix, and you're like, all right, well, I'm not going to get those. But on the flip side, the Roberto Clemente Award, that's something that the Roberto Clemente family is voting on. People are seeing, people are doing, you know, people know who's being impactful and helping and thinking about others in so many different ways, whether you're in a small market or you're in a big market. And even a number of times prior to actually winning the big award, I was named the Roberto Clemente Award recipient for my respective team I was on. So that just means so much, especially because it's an individual that was taken away from us doing the thing that made him so impactful, and that was giving back to the community. So it's one of the pieces of hardware that I actually do not have at my house. My parents have that one and have yet to give it back to me. That's how cool and exciting it is. They're holding on to it.
Oh, that's funny. Do you want it back, or are you content with them keeping it? For right now,
they can have it for now. Eventually, I'll go ahead and get it. But that's the one that I'm like, all right, come on, let me get it. Nah, we're gonna hold on to this one for right now.
So obviously, your philanthropic work is well documented and well known. I'm curious, what about your grandkids' foundation are you the most proud of right now, and say in 30 years, you can look back and say, you know, I'm really proud that we were able to do this.
I started the Grandkids Foundation in 2007, and it's amazing that we're still able to continue to keep going right now. That's one thing that jumps out. And I remember attending a Derek Jeter event for his Turn 2 Foundation in New York. And I remember them raising, you know, millions of dollars, like 1.2 or something like that. And I was like, wow, that's truly awesome. Like, they were able to do so much, and they raised so much, and they have all these big names and big businesses and corporations in here. I want to do that. Not because I want to be a mount, but just because I knew I can have more impact with the more dollars in front of me. But then I remember having my first ever like fundraiser luncheon with the Grandkids Foundation, and we raised, I want to say maybe $1,000 or something like that. And at first I thought it was a failure, and I was like, wow, we only raised $1,000. Then I thought about it, said that $1,000 is still going to be very impactful and still help so many people. It may not help $1 million worth of people, but the people that will help, it's going to be very impactful. And from that point, I just shifted how I looked at it. And now, fast forward to here we are now, my Grandkids Foundation has partnered with Mariano's Grocery Stores in the Chicagoland area through our Grand Giving Initiative throughout the month of November, where we raise funds to help fight food insecurity. And all the proceeds go to the Greater Chicago Food Depository and the Northern Illinois Food Bank. And over the course of 10 years partnering with them, we've been able to raise over $1 million, which has provided so many meals to families in need. So it's funny to look back and say, wow, you know, they were raising that much money. It just took me a little bit of time to continue to get going and to be able to have this impact and just keep going after the things that you find important. So those are going to be the biggest things that I look back on, that when I started in 07, it's still going. And two, in time, we were able to go ahead and start having those big impactful numbers that I saw as a fan, seeing other foundations and charities do great things.
So I wanted to turn your attention to something else that I know is near and dear to your heart, and that is the Players Alliance. And I want to ask, how do you envision or how do you hope that the Players Alliance grows from here?
The big thing with the Players Alliance is that it's all player initiatives. So when we're looking at different issues that we see both on and off the field, the players are offering up the solutions, and we're out there implementing them primarily with player dollars. Everything up until this point that I speak to you right now has all been funded by the player donations from our big pull-up neighbor cross-country tour, where we handed out COVID supplies, handed out food to food insecure neighborhoods, and handed out baseball equipment. That was all supported by the players. We've recently done some Equip the Future events where we get out and we're talking to kids, talking about the challenges, letting them see us face to face, asking questions, doing all those great things. We've helped out in communities in the Mississippi Delta. We've helped out in communities in Memphis. We've helped out in international communities. Again, all with player funded dollars. Now, we do have a great partnership with the Major League Baseball Players Association and Major League Baseball, where a lot of funds are coming in from them. But one of our biggest fundraisers that we have is our Jackie Robinson Day Game Day Pay, where players can donate their game day pay from that day to the Players Alliance to be able to go out there and just continue to all keep moving in the right direction. So now being, I think, 2.5, almost 3 years in, we got the word out. We're starting to make some impact. We're able to provide opportunities for players that want to be in the game, especially the young players that are unfortunately not being able to remain or stay or even get started because of the financial burden. Whether that's getting them uniforms, getting them equipment, getting them access, refurbishing fields. These are just some of the different things that we've been able to do up to this point. So the sky is truly the limit because, as you know, you start talking to players, there's a lot of ideas and challenges that you may or may not have heard of until you talk to a player from the West Coast or from the South or from the Midwest or from this background or from that neighborhood. And those are the things that we definitely want to go ahead and try to tackle.
So, I want to ask a question about your post-baseball career. So, you're obviously very involved with the Players Alliance right now. You're doing work for TV for MLB Network. So, I wanted to ask, how do you envision, as we move forward, how do you envision your post-baseball career taking shape? Would you like to stay in TV? Would you like to maybe, say, get into the coaching ranks? How do
I
you
definitely
see
don't
your
want to coach. Yeah, I
baseball
definitely don't want to coach.
career?
I definitely don't want to coach. Yeah, I've had a ton of coaches throughout the course of my career, and that's one thing I do not want to do. And it's not because I dislike the coaches. I love all the coaches I've ever had. I just know, especially at the pro level, towards the end of my career, the amount of hours those coaches were putting in, I don't want to do that. So, and I feel like I could have so much more impact without actually having to be a coach. So whether it's something like the Players Alliance or it's mentoring and motivating or it's talking, the broadcasting has been fun. I have no idea how long that will take shape or you know, even that this was going to be a possibility like that. But I have enjoyed it. I got a great team and staff over there with Turner, Pedro Martinez, and Jimmy Rollins over there. So that's been fun. So if that continues to present itself, great. The Players Alliance has taken shape. There's just other initiatives that I see that could hopefully be improved to help the game of baseball that I would like to my best to try to, if I can have a voice in it based off my experience and things I think may work or things that definitely work for me, I would definitely like to try my best to be able to do that.
So my final question I have for you on the day involves the Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame, you said?
Yes. Yeah. I actually, and I asked this question in part because I interned.
Hold on one
second. Because I interned at the Hall of Fame last summer.
Hold on one second, Nicholas. Hold on one second.
Okay. Okay.
Sorry, I'm walking, and I have my son. My wife has my daughter. She's went somewhere else, so baby's sleeping in the stroller, and this lady who's expecting comes up and says, "Hey, I registered for that stroller you have. What do you think about it?" So I was like, I got to let the lady know. This is one of our favorite strollers, so my bad on that.
No worries. So my final question for you is about the Hall of Fame. And I asked this question because I actually last summer had the great honor of interning at the Hall of Fame, and it gave
That's awesome.
It was the greatest experience of my life, hands down, no questions asked. But it gave me such a greater respect for not only the institution, but the history of the game and what the game has meant in the larger context of American society. And I just looked this up. So next year, in 2025, your name, Curtis Granderson, will be appearing on BBWAA ballot, and you will be eligible to have guys vote on your name for induction into Cooperstown. And I want to know, yes, and I want to know two things. What does that mean to you that your name will be A, appearing on ballot, but B, more importantly, I want to find out what would it mean to you to get that call from the Hall of Fame announcing that you have been inducted forever and ever into the Hall of Fame with baseball's greatest all-time players? Is that something that you think about?
I it's weird. I never really thought about it, kind of going to one of the questions you had before in terms of like the awards and the accolades. Mm-hmm. Partly because if we go back to one of my first ever, you know, questions you asked me, I was always just the, you know, unselfishy type of player. And I never, ever considered myself the best. I always considered myself good or able to be in the group because I knew where I was playing, but I never looked at myself and go, okay, I'm the best player. I'm a future Hall of Famer. I'm this, I'm that. So even when people started saying, oh, you're going to potentially be it, I just laugh. I'm like, there's no chance I'm going to be in that mix. But if I do get on the ballot for the first thing, that'd be awesome. But at the same time, I still just don't see myself like getting the votes. I mean, I'm looking at players that I was huge fans of not get in, like Andrew Jones, for example. And go, okay, well, if he didn't get in, then I got no chance, you know? or even players like King Griffey Jr. who didn't get 100%. You go, okay, all right, well, what didn't he do where the first whoever said no was saying no? And now you start to say, okay, well, part of that comes from the comparison to the other players that are in. And you start looking at it that way and go, what some of those players that are in have done is truly amazing. Just from stats, from longevity. The true impact on the game. And as much as I want to have as much impact as I have, I'm short in regards to all those players that are in there. So it would be great to just even be mentioned and have that conversation. If it were to happen, it would be truly unbelievable. But I don't look at it any different way and, you know, plan on stopping on that particular day to be ready for it, because I just don't see it happening. Very similar to when I got drafted, I thought I'd play for 2 to 3 years, get released, and that would be it. You know, there's no different when it comes to stuff like this.
Well, Curtis, again, I would like to personally thank you for taking time out of your schedule to conduct this interview on behalf of Staver's oral history project.
You're welcome. I'm so sorry that we had a delay. I appreciate you adapting and adjusting with me on it and being accommodating, especially if you took some time off. Like,
No
oh, I feel
worries.
so bad on that. But yeah, and as soon as I saw it popping, I was like, oh, let me get it. And as I'm doing it, like I said, I'm on this trip. I'm in Target and I see the alert pop up. I go, oh no, I can't Zoom here in Target right now. So let me finish my shopping, get home, get the headphones, call you up. And I'm glad we were able to make it work. You know, it's
I
awesome, you
am
know, the
too.
different topics we chatted about. If you need any follow-up or anything like that, you got my number, you got my email, just let me know.
And I don't know if I mentioned to you before I let you go. My goal is I would like to use this interview. So Staber, I'm not sure if you're aware, they also have a biography project, where there are 5,000 plus word biographies on. The goal is to have one on every player who's ever appeared in at least one major league game. And my goal is to use this interview to write one for you, is to write one for
Oh,
you.
nice. That'd be
So
awesome, man. I
so
appreciate
I
that.
may be contacting you again in the future for some more information.
That sounds good. You got my info. And do you live in Lansing now?
I do. I still live in Lansing. I currently work, as I was telling you on the phone prior, I work for Lansing School District 158. I've lived in Lansing my entire life. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, just let me know and hopefully you're able to do that, to get it done. If you need anything else, obviously, like I said, text or email me and we'll roll and go from there. Thanks for taking the time. Great questions across the board. Definitely know you did your research and everything on everything, which is again respectable, and I appreciate that.
And I want to thank you because I'm not I'm